Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about the very first arrivals of the Red Army in the capitals of Europe at the end of the Second World War, often referred to amongst the populations of Hungary, Poland, and East Germany as Zero Hour, or in German, Stund Null. I'm going to be looking at Anne Applebaum's book, Iron Curtain, and if you recall, I've often talked about her overview history of the Stalin's Gulag system. And so I've got a lot to say for Anne Applebaum and her writing. She's really, really quite... is the detail and the thoroughness and the exhaustive source work that she does really, really makes Iron Curtain an excellent read and a very good kind of guide to the period 45 to 53 or thereabouts. So she looks in the first chapter of the book at Berlin, Budapest, and Warsaw. Warsaw is obviously first, Eastern is liberated the first, but there's not really much to liberate. The Nazis had razed 90% of the city to the ground following the Warsaw Uprising. And she quotes Ladislaw Spielmann. If you've seen the film The Pianist, Spielmann was the Jewish-Polish concert pianist who survived the Holocaust. And he writes in 1945, on the 16th of January 1945, 11 days before the liberation of Auschwitz. A silence such as even Warsaw, a dead city for the last 3 months, had not known before, fell. I could not even hear the steps of the guards outside the building. I could not understand it. The following morning, the silence was broken by a loud and resonant noise, the last sound I expected. The Red Army had arrived, and their loudspeakers were broadcasting a message in Polish throughout the city, saying that the city had been liberated. Now, one of the books I looked at some time ago was Kenneth Lowe's Savage Continent, and it really makes the point that fighting and violence did not end in 1945, but a whole host of new ethnic rivalries and the violent repression of not just Germany, but of much of occupied Eastern Europe began under the Soviet Union. And the liberation that Warsaw is treated to is not dissimilar to that the Berliners experience Red Army soldiers are every bit as violent and predatory towards Poles as they are towards Germans. The only factor that makes it any different is, of course, when the Red Army reach Germany, they are bent on revenge, and they see some kind of legitimacy to what they are doing. The 12th of February 1945, when the siege of Budapest came to an end, and if you want to know more about the siege of Budapest, I have done a podcast on it sometime last year. Normally, when I say sometime last year, it turns out it's like 2 or 3 years ago, which is about the alarming passage of time. But there you go. The siege of Budapest came to an end on the 12th of February, and a Hungarian civil servant wrote, "I got to Castle District, not a soul anywhere. I walked along Verbocci Street, nothing but bodies and ruins, supply carts and drays. I got to Stentharum Slag Square and decided to look in at the council in case I found somebody there, deserted. Everything turned upside down and not a soul." So the world that the conquerors of the Red Army inherited was one that had been comprehensively devastated by both the German army and the Red Army, and in this case the fascist forces of the Arrow Cross and the Hungarian Szilassi regime. So the Red Army were immensely aided, and the Soviet regime was immensely aided in its task of colonising Eastern Europe by the fact that the entire half of the continent had been reduced to abject destitution and anarchy. There, literally, in Warsaw and in Budapest, is no government to depose. In Berlin, the situation is remarkably similar. One diarist wrote that when the Red Army finally took control of the streets, "The night was far too quiet," wrote one chronicler. "Not a civilian in sight. The Russians have the streets entirely to themselves, but under every building people are whispering, quaking. Who could ever imagine such a world, hidden here, so frightened, right in the middle of a big city?" The norms and the practices of everyday life are completely overturned by war and by the fall of the regime. And these two events happening simultaneously, that not only is the country under siege and the capital city under siege, but also the regime has effectively abdicated all ability to rule, all responsibility to rule at the same time. And the wish of nearly all Berliners at this point is simply, for one way and another, for the fighting to end. And the desperation for simply any kind of break in the hostilities means that when they do end, and they end on obviously Soviet terms, there is some manner of relief. Across Germany, it should be pointed out, a mass wave of suicides breaks out as people, not simply just ardent Nazi members, but ordinary Germans who cannot envisage the horrors of life under Soviet rule, take their own lives. Anne Applebaum writes, "Although it is logical to begin any history of the communist takeover of Eastern Europe with the end of the war, it is, in some ways, deeply misleading. The people of the region were not faced with a blank slate in 1944 or 1945, after all, and they were not themselves starting from scratch, nor did they emerge from nowhere, with no previous experiences, ready to start afresh. Instead, they climbed out of basements of their destroyed homes, or walked out of forests where they had been living as partisans, or slipped away from the labour camp where they had been imprisoned, or if they were healthy enough, embarked on the long, complicated journeys back to their homelands. Not all of them even stopped fighting when the Germans surrendered. As they crawled out of the ruins, they saw not virgin territory, but destruction. And of course, in all these cities, the living were cheek by jowl with the dead. across Berlin, Budapest, Warsaw, and other European cities, particularly the cities of the east, which had been the battlegrounds between the Red Army and the Wehrmacht, the dead remained unburied. There was the air was full and suffused with the scent of the decomposing bodies of neighbours, friends, and loved ones. So the devastation of Europe, the chaos that the war had brought, the flattened and destroyed cities, the vast hectareage of farmland destroyed, the lost generations of people to work the land and to make society grow, the concentration camps, and most of all the Holocaust, were the way in which inadvertently the Nazis gifted Eastern Europe to Stalin. The chaos that the Nazi regime had wrought opened the door to Stalinism to march as far as Berlin. And as Anthony Beaver always points out in his various histories of the Second World War, that had initiatives such as D-Day failed, the Red Army may well have ended its march not at Berlin, but at Calais. One of the interesting, perhaps slightly unsurprising, given the times in which these sorts of things have happened before, but one of the interesting features of Warsaw particularly is within a few weeks how the city starts to come to life again. That the marketplaces begin to fill, people begin to buy and sell the things that they need, repairs start to be done to buildings, electricity begins to be switched back on, and even a tram is running within the first few weeks of liberation. The diarist Stefan Kieślowski writes, "In the ruins of the streets, there's commotion like never before. Trade buzzing, work booming, humour everywhere. The mob teeming life flows through the streets. Nobody would think that these are all victims of a massive disaster, people who have scarcely recovered from a catastrophe, or that they are living in extreme inhuman conditions." And during the Russian Civil War, during the period of war communism, and famine and internecine strife, when the policy of war communism was lifted very quickly during Lenin's new economic policy era, the towns of Russia and cities and marketplaces very quickly fill with small traders looking to survive. Commerce very rapidly returns. Sándor Mirai spoke of Budapest, saying, "Whatever remained of the city, of society, sprang to life with such passion, fury and sheer willpower, with such strength and stamina and cunning, it seemed as if nothing had happened. Out on the boulevard there were certain stalls and gateways, selling all kinds of nice food and luxury items, clothes, shoes, everything you could imagine, not to mention the gold Napoleons, morphine and pork lard. The Jews who remained staggered from their yellow star houses, and within a week or two you could see them bargaining, surrounded as they were by the corpses of men and horses. People were quibbling over prices for warm British cloth, French perfumes, Dutch brandy and Swiss watches among the rubble."
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The desire for a return to normality seems to have been a key motivator in this extraordinary explosion of creative energies. Polish and Hungarian diarists and memoirists talking about this period focus on the urgent need for things such as a return to education and work and family life. And the attraction is obviously, you know, very profound. These have been things that have been torn out of Polish life, firstly by Hitler. There are some interesting parallels between the mindset of Hitler and Stalin when it came to countries such as Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia, these buffer states that had emerged after the Treaty of Versailles. In order to create what the French had called the cordon sanitaire, partly to hem in the Soviet Union, but also, as far as the British and French were concerned, to create a democratic barrier between Germany and the Soviet Union, lest they decide to meet up and become friends. A very unpalatable thought as far as Western democratic states were concerned. When Hitler came to power, he viewed particularly Poland, but also Czechoslovakia, as states that had no right to exist. He said that these were fictions created by the Treaty of Versailles, mongrel nations pieced together through political expediency. They had no right to exist, and they did not follow the kind of racial system of Hitler's imagining. And also, they incorporated German minorities. So these were countries that which were German territory in his eyes, and simply contained Slavic squatters who could now be flung off their land and sent, who knows where. Stalin looked at these states in a slightly different way, but with no more sense of legitimacy. The way Stalin viewed them were that they were a kind of a dangerous, they were dangerous neighbours. The porous border between Poland and Ukraine, for example, during the Soviet famines, meant in Stalin's eyes that troublemakers, anti-Soviet troublemakers, would cross over from Poland into Ukraine and whip up discontent amongst the kulaks, and thus create the conditions for Stalin to have to bring about violent anti-Kulak actions. Of course, this is largely nonsense. But it is true that these borders were highly porous. Stalin looked at any state along his borders with immense suspicion and saw them as being the kind of the means by which not just people but ideas could filter into the Soviet Union. And it was the ideas particularly that Stalin saw as threatening and dangerous. So one of the reasons for establishing a Soviet cordon sanitaire, a buffer zone, was to make sure that there were that if any future war would be fought on Eastern Europe, not on Soviet territory, but also to make sure that dangerous ideas, dangerous thoughts, and troublemakers in general didn't exist on the Soviet border, that they were that the danger was pushed back to Western Europe. Whilst there were some uneasy relations in the West between resistance fighters in countries such as France and Anglo-American troops, in the East, the situation is entirely different. For the most part, in the West, There was some grudging admiration of partisans and resistance fighters, and some limited sense of common cause. In the East, liberated partisans, unless they had been officially Soviet-sanctioned and Comintern-sanctioned, were seen as dangerous, and there was every reason to arrest or execute them, as there was to attack the retreating Nazis. And in the West, whilst the collaborationist governments of Western Europe, such as France and Italy, and to some extent the Netherlands, shipped their Jews to Auschwitz with no small amount of collaboration and participation. What can be said to be true is that those states at the end of the war were all intact. They hadn't been dismantled. The governments were still there. The governments still functioned. They may have been occupied by the German army, but by and large, it is French and Italian passport clerks who are, or railway officials who are deciding where Jews are sent. In Eastern Europe, not only have the governments been either overthrown or are, in the case of Hungary, under Horthy, and then later under Szilágyi, so powerfully controlled by the Nazi regime that they are almost barely non-functioning as independent entities themselves. In Eastern Europe, in Poland, in the Baltic states, there is no government. There is a kind of a form of grassroots sort of anarchy, stateless anarchy, and on high a totalitarian colonizing force. And the reason that the Holocaust is able to be perpetrated in its final form, in the form of Auschwitz and the other camps in Poland, is based around this, is because there is essentially no functioning state there. And therefore it is far easier to turn somewhere like Poland into a laboratory for genocide, trying different approaches to mass killing. As a result of this, as a result of the fact that the Eastern Europe is where the Red Army and the Nazis met in battle for the most part, the world in which survivors emerged into was radically different from those of their Western counterparts. There were, for example, some 5.5 million Polish deaths during the war, or thereabouts, and some 6 to 9 million, perhaps, German deaths, whereas the sum total of British military and civilian deaths as up to 360,000 individuals. And this isn't to downplay the losses on the Western Front. Obviously, these are huge in their own right. But the world in which the Red Army turned up in, the countries that the Red Army conquered, not only had been devastated physically, but on a deep kind of, I guess, existential, almost psychical level, individuals were coming to terms with the fact that vast chunks of their population had simply been annihilated in the most horrific of manners. And I think what this perhaps does is make it a lot easier to present a society with an ultimatum, and to be able to seize power by exploiting dislocation and trauma. And of course, one must also remember the unintentional diasporas of Europe, the people who had been scattered through forced labour and evacuation throughout Eastern Europe, and many who had been taken into Germany against their will. So the fact that there were people who were very mobile, trying to get home, who were poorly clothed, poorly fed, hungry and desperate, also presented the Soviets with a historically unprecedented opportunity. Communism very often has manifested itself at times of acute hunger. And in the period 1945 to 48, this is no different. And it was a superb device for enabling people to acquiesce to Soviet rule. And the expulsion by the communist regimes, or the regimes of national unity that established themselves, which had this kind of strong communist components who would later take over across Eastern Europe, of German colonists and of ethnic German populations, meant that the new states of Eastern Europe would be far more racially and ethnically homogenous than Hitler could ever have dreamt of. And this ethnic homogeneity would later serve the purposes of the communists, believing that Germanness and the Germans were inherently fascist, and by kicking them out, it was possible to have some kind of anti-fascist nation and to forge new national identities out of anti-fascism. Anti-fascism, of course, being a code for Soviet communism. Now, I'm going to talk a lot more about the conquest of Eastern Europe. There's a heck of a lot to say on it, and I'm trying to bring my bit-by-bit history of the Second World War up to date as well. So hopefully these things are going to kind of dovetail. So stay tuned for more of this. Pop by our Facebook page. I'm going to put a link here underneath this this podcast, and our Facebook group, I beg your pardon. There's some really interesting stuff starting to happen there, so swing by. There's new content on there, and it's great to hear people's views and observations. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.